How could things get so bad in a town that it becomes what we call a ghost town? For some, the town's economic activity ends, like that of an old mining town. For others, human activity or natural disasters may cause the locals to leave. But for one Alaskan town, legend has it that Bigfoot, or something similar, turned it into a ghost town. Here's how today's project goes. A Bigfoot-like creature terrorized the town of Portlock, Alaska, including killing citizens, until the residents of the town fled en masse by 1950 after a number of unsolved murders and disappearances. So is this folklore or fact? As always, we're going to see what the evidence says. And it turns out the people in this story are almost as interesting as the supposed monster in the woods. But there might actually be a monster in the woods. Let's make conspiracies great again. My name is Face, and welcome to Project Conspiracy. Portlock was established in the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska in the early 1900s as a cannery town. For reference, that's on the peninsula in the southern part of Alaska. This area had been home to the Sukpiak people for centuries. The town of Portlock was named after Captain Nathaniel Portlock, a British ship captain who sailed there, or at least got pretty close, in 1786. He also got a harbor and a bay named after him, so productive journey for him. The town of Portlock was also known as Port Chatham. I may refer to it as Port Chatham at some point, so if I do that, you'll know what I'm talking about. About a century later, in 1867, the United States purchased Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million, and Alaska became a United States territory. The U.S. was getting some serious land deals in the 1800s. And let's remember the situation in Alaska in the early 1900s when Portlock was founded. This is not exactly a developed area. There were no roads or trails to Portlock, and the only way to get there was by boat. And that's still the case today. Even so, in the 1910s, Portlock's economy and industry ran smoothly. They did the typical Alaska stuff there, hunting, fishing, that sort of thing. But the largest employer was Portlock Cannery, where fresh salmon was processed and canned. And the town sort of became official when it got a post office in 1921. Portlock first appeared on the 1940 census with 31 residents. Now, Portlock obviously had people before that, and we're about to get to them. But it's not really disputed that Portlock was abandoned by 1950, and the census didn't show anyone in Portlock in 1960 or 1970. But in a weird turn of events, the 1980 census does show 31 residents of Portlock. Probably a clerical error, maybe a glitch in the matrix. But that's not the only weird thing about Portlock. Many say that there was a Bigfoot-like monster there waiting to strike, and it did. Allegedly. Let's get into it. After Portlock was established, they say that mysterious deaths and other strange things started happening around the town. The internet is insistent that the townspeople believe something was out there. And there's reports of two different entities. The one that we're going to focus on today is the Bigfoot-like creature. They call it the Nantinook. It was a huge, hairy, ape-like creature that was said to be hostile towards humans. This is something that makes the Nantinook different than what we normally hear about Bigfoot. And the Nantinook has been around in the Sookstun culture for a long time. By the way, if I butcher the pronunciation of any non-English words, apologies. I made a good faith effort to look up the pronunciations, but I wasn't able to find all of them. Roughly translated, Nantinook means half man, half beast. Though some say that the creature's condition might actually be a tragic situation, because it might have once been fully human. Others say it might be more of a supernatural type being. Nantinook has been found in the Chugach dialect of Sukpiak Alutik that's used in the Kenai Peninsula dialect. It's borrowed from the Dena'ina word Nantina, which means those who steal people. It's also said that Nantina refers to a folklore type character, a sort of wild people who kidnap children, usually found in tales to scare children so that they didn't wander off into the woods. So that's a brief introduction to our monster today. And we're going to talk about almost every story I could find about the Nantinook. And this is one of those tales where the sources of information become part of the story itself. Drama alert! So I'll do my best to let you know when the source is important. So let's learn a little more about what the Nantinook supposedly did to the people of Portlock. One of the earliest stories of strange activity in the Portlock area comes from Ed. Ed is a mostly anonymous source who gave some accounts from the area. He's said to have had a personal encounter in the 1970s that spooked him so bad that he started looking into what might be out there. We'll talk about his personal encounter in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about Ed's research. He claimed to have found a story about the creature in a 1935 Alaskan Sportsman magazine letter to the editor. Someone reportedly found a letter of their relative describing what happened in the Portlock area in 1905. Here's how it goes.
The year was 1905. It said that the cannery employed a small group of Aleuts from a small village in Portlock Bay during salmon season. Their camp was about a mile from the cannery buildings. One day, all the Aleuts moved out of the village and paddled their baidarkas back to Port Graham. The letter said that the Aleuts claimed that a hairy man was bothering and frightening them to the point where they had to leave.
They say that the cannery wasn't able to operate without its workers. And even though they set up armed guards to ensure the workers' protection, it took a year for the workers to return to the area.
I have since done some research into the subject and found written histories of natives from Seldovia to Port Graham being frightened and bothered by something. They even have a native name for it. It doesn't translate into English very well.
Sounds a lot like the Nantinook, and the weird stuff kept happening after that. In the 1920s, there were reports of gold prospectors and hunters frequently going missing. Some of the bodies were found dismembered in a creek. This caused many to believe that something more was going on. Some of these stories came from a Port Graham Sukpiak elder who we're going to call Simeon in a 2009 article in the Homer Tribune. Homer, by the way, is further north on the other side of the bay. More on Homer in just a minute. Simeon said that he remembers when the Bigfoot-like creature was blamed for the disappearance of a gold miner.
This one guy over there had a little place where he was digging for gold. He went up there one time and never came back. No one found any sign of him.
Now, it certainly wasn't unheard of for people to go missing in Alaska back then, especially in this area with its harsh weather conditions and forest predators. But what was strange is how often people would vanish near Portlock. There were also reports that trees were completely ripped out of the ground, turned upside down, and thrust back into the ground. Must have been the wind. The unusual activity continued in the 1930s, and some of the information we have for this time period comes from Melania Helen Kell. Most of what I was able to find about Melania came from that Homer Tribune article in 2009. So Melania was born on January 25th, 1934 in Port Chatham, aka Portlock. When Melania was a baby, the family abruptly moved from Port Chatham, leaving the house behind.
We left our houses and the school and started all new here in Nanwalek.
Nanwalek is a town sort of in between Portlock and Homer. So Portlock is further south, Nanwalek is north of Portlock, and Homer is north and across the bay from Nanwalek. Melania said that it hadn't been a single event that caused her family to leave. Rather, over a long period of time, the Nantinook was reportedly terrorizing villagers. That said, Melania did have a personal story about the creature. Melania's godfather, Andrew Camluck, was logging in 1931 when he was found dead to a blow to the back of the head. According to Melania's story in the Homer Tribune, someone or something appeared to have hit him over the head with a piece of log-moving equipment. The blow reportedly killed him instantly. I found other reports that said when Camluck's body was found, he was 10 feet from the logging equipment and there was blood on it as well. There didn't seem to be any way that Camluck could have slipped and fallen or simply hit his head unintentionally on the equipment. They say it looked as if someone or something picked it up, hit him over the head, and tossed the heavy piece of equipment aside. Melania also told of a spirit woman dressed in draping black clothes that would come out of the cliffs.
Her dress was so long she would drag it. She had a very white face and would disappear back into the cliffs.
We're not too worried about the spirit woman story today, but I wanted to make you aware of it because I'm going to mention it again later when we're trying to figure this stuff out. Melania said that once they moved to Nanwalek, the Nantinook stayed far away and left them in peace. Melania grew up, raised 13 children, and at the time of the article remained one of the few regional elders that could pass on the old traditions. The article closes by noting that Melania was a favorite among the young people of Nanwalek, especially when she told stories. But there were other stories of strange happenings around Portlock in the 1930s. They say that some cannery workers went for a walk in the forest near Portlock. They never returned, and when they were found, at least one of their bodies was found horribly mutilated. It seemed unlikely that the typical forest predators could have carried out such a vicious attack. Then, some hunters tracking a large moose came across what they claimed were 18-inch-long, human-like footprints leading to some flattened brush. Some say that there were signs of a short struggle where the grass had been matted down, then only the deep tracks of the man-like animal departing towards the high, fog-shrouded mountains. And then we have the story of Tom Larson. His story was told by Simeon, the Port Graham Sukpiak elder, in the Homer Tribune article that we looked at a few moments ago. Simeon's story recounted the experience of sawmill owner Tom Larson, who had a job cutting wood for the old fish traps.
He told of spotting Nantianak on the beach once. After going back to his house to get his gun, He returned to the beach and the thing looked at him. For some reason, Larson decided against firing a shot.
And failing to take the shot is a pretty consistent theme in the Bigfoot community, too. We've all heard stories of hunters deciding not to shoot Bigfoot because it looked too human-like. But eventually, the people of Portlock had enough. One source says that by about 1936, the people of Port Chatham left the village en masse. This is actually consistent with the story of Melania, who was born in 1934 and said her family moved when she was a baby. Though some seem to insinuate that the exodus actually took place later, with the postmaster being the last resident of Portlock. When the post office finally closed in 1950, the postmaster left and Portlock was officially a ghost town. By 1950, Portlock was a ghost town. So how is it that stories of the Nantinook kept coming out of the area? According to Alaska Magazine, in 1968, a goat hunter was tracking game in the Portlock area. While there, he was suddenly chased by a creature that scared him out of the area. It's not clear whether the hunter thought it was simply a predator or one of the supernatural creatures. The next encounter comes from our mostly anonymous source, Ed. Ed gave a story about a personal encounter in August of 1973. Here's what he said. Ed and two others were bow hunting for goats in the remote wilderness of the Lower Cook Inlet around the area of Portlock when a storm forced them to take shelter in the Dogfish Bay Lagoon. In August in Alaska, there's still some light in the sky until about 10 or 11 at night. According to Ed, when the sun went down, the weirdness started up.
We beached our skiff and let the tide run her dry. After a dinner of broiled salmon, we turned into our tent. The sky was clear, but the wind was howling through the old growth timber that lined the shore. Sometime around 2 a.m., my friend Dennis woke me up by squeezing my leg. I could dimly see his face in the tent. His finger was across his lips. I listened. Then I heard it. A step. A man was quietly walking outside or our tent, taking very deliberate steps. Not a bear. Scenes from the movie Deliverance flashed through my mind. We woke Joe, the third member of our party, with the same leg grab and finger to the lips. The walking, or rather sneaking, continued until it half circled our tent and then all was quiet. Except for the wind.
Ed said that they were all embarrassed that the incident scared them. But those fears were justified because it happened again the next night.
We had a flashlight and the rifle in the tent between us, locked and loaded. I finally dozed off but woke right up when Dennis squeezed my leg. The illuminated hands of my watch showed it was 2:30. Joe was already sitting up and had the rifle in hand. I heard the first step, not more than about 10 feet from the back of the tent. Slowly. Then another and another. Whatever this was, it sounded like it was walking on 2 feet. It made the same semicircle around the tent. When we finally got enough courage to crawl out of the tent and turn the flashlight on, we saw nothing. No tracks, nothing.
According to Ed, the men were now legitimately scared after this second incident. So much so that they had determined that they were coming out of their tents, guns blazing, if the creature came back again. But it didn't come back the third night they were there. Then they got a break in the weather and got out of the area. And that's Ed's personal encounter. Ed, if you're watching and would like to come on the show and tell your story, join our Discord. We've got a personal encounter section in there. It's all part of the project to document the weird stuff that goes on in this strange world and maybe try to make some sense of it. People are seeing weird things. I believe that. So jump in there and tell us your personal ghost story, or when you had a time slip or experienced a glitch in the Matrix, or when you saw Bigfoot or Nantinook. I'm looking at you, Ed. If we can collect and compare these stories, maybe we can get a little closer to figuring out what's going on. But back to the evidence. The story of the Nantinook is not complete without talking about Sally Ash. Sally is a Sukpiak of Russian Aleut descent. She has lived in Nanuelik for most of her life and continues to speak her native language of Sukston. Her mother was born in Dogfish Bay near Port Chatham. And here's where it gets interesting. Sally also served as a translator for her cousin, Melania, during her 2009 interview with the Homer Tribune that we discussed earlier. And Sally says that when her cousin Melania was being interviewed, Sally was sitting next to her. Remember, Melania basically told the reporter that Portlock had been abandoned due to the murderous Nantinook. And Sally had a startling confession.
Melania kind of made up a story because she was getting tired of people asking if this story is true. She made up this story about how Bigfoot was killing people. It wasn't true. Everybody knows that, but it was not our place to say nothing. We all knew, but we couldn't just stop her. We were brought up in a way where we can't tell our elders they are wrong.
So is that it? It's all made up? We solved another one. Well, not quite. While Sally said that Melania made up what she told the paper in 2009, Sally said they really did tell stories of the Nantinook.
Portlock was kind of a creepy place. They'd tell us don't go out on a foggy day. That's when he's walking around. You could run into him and you never know what he might do.
And Sally apparently believed that the Nazi note was real. And she even had her own story, which looks like it took place around the 1980s.
My brother went up to the lake. He was tying off his skiff. He started smelling something really bad in the bushes, so he opened it, moving the branches. Something's going on here. Then he looked in there and there was a man with his hands, in the back way, turned around. It looked like a man, but he was all hairy and he looked really scary. So he and our cousin took off running and didn't want to be up there. He wasn't sure if it was a Bigfoot, but there was a horrible smell.
And a horrible smell is a recurring theme both with the Nanti Nook and Bigfoots. Bigfeet? Bigfoots? Sally also gave us a description of the entity.
I think he is part human. He lived with people and then didn't want to be around them anymore, so he moved to the forest, away from everybody. He started growing hair and he looked like a Bigfoot, scary. My uncles, my grandfathers, they all talked about him. They'd tell us they live far away from people. They don't mix with people.
Sally said that she thinks it's a male and that it's been living for a long time.
He's old, he's tall, he's strong, he's hairy. It lives in the woods and you can tell when he's getting near. You can smell him. My mom used to talk about it a lot. She'd tell stories of the Bigfoot, like in Dogfish area. Her and her brother would talk about how Bigfoot was around. They were getting too close to him and they would be nice to him. Respect him. Keep distance. They live with him but not so close. He moved around. He was quick.
To Sally, it seemed like the best way to stay out of trouble with the creature was to respect it.
When we go through that area, we are careful not to make waves and be noisy. We don't want to bother it or offend it because then we might have problems. We don't know how he'll react to us. So that's why we respect it and stay away from it. We know the signs and not to chase it around.
She said that the legend of the Nanti Nook didn't just start. The Sukpiak people always knew the story, but they also knew that it wasn't a bloodbath like it was being told.
Bigfoot never kill anybody. If anything, he ran away. He didn't want to be around people. He's out there. He lives among us.
And there's one article that seems to support what Sally said, at least the part about the lack of deaths in the area during the relevant time frame. One researcher, Brian Dunning from the Skeptoid podcast, talked about the Alaska Digital Newspaper Program, which has provided over 250,000 pages scanned to the Library of Congress, covering newspapers from the late 1700s to 1963. He says that a single death from the city made it into the papers in all those years, a man who died in an accident in 1920. No further details were given. As far as any missing persons reports go, newspapers reported only one, and it was two hunters, Ben Sweezy and Bill Weaver, who left on a two-week trip by dory boat in 1917 and were never seen again. They weren't from Portlock. They were from Seward, a city very far away. Someone in Portlock claimed to have found a dory boat around this time that could have been the one that these two missing people were on. But Portlock was like 1,000 miles away from where they left. And at a minimum, they would have had to have crossed at least 100 miles of open ocean to get to Portlock. Seems pretty unlikely. Also doesn't seem to have anything to do with the Nanti Nook. Or maybe these two people got to Portlock, put on a Bigfoot costume, and proceeded to freak out the locals for decades until they finally scared them all off. The world's a weird place. It's tough to rule anything out. But here are my thoughts on the lack of reported deaths that we just talked about. It's a data point to be taken into consideration. But it's not clear to me what records and newspapers for this area were maintained in the Library of Congress. I can also imagine all sorts of ways that a death might not make it into a 1930s rural Alaskan newspaper. I also doubt they had perfect records back then. We still don't today. All of that considered, what Sally Ash said about this situation makes it as clear as mud. Sally first says that Melania was making it all up. Then Sally gives us more evidence that would seem to support the existence of Nanti Nook. She even seemed to believe it was real and had been taught how to act around it. So, what the heck is really going on? Well, I've got some theories to run past you. So, what really happened in Portlock? Well, I've got some theories for your consideration. Theory 1. The natives, like Melania, are messing with us to keep us off their land. Believe it or not, it looks like there could actually be motive for this, and maybe even some circumstantial evidence. So the land that was Portlock is now owned by the Chugach Alaskan Corporation, or CAC. The CAC is one of 13 Alaska Native regional corporations created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 in settlement of the Aboriginal land claims. The CAC was incorporated in 1972 and is headquartered in Anchorage, Alaska. It's a for-profit corporation with over 2,200 Alaska Native shareholders of several different descents. We didn't talk about this one earlier, but one of the first articles about the strange stuff in Portlock was in an April 15, 1973 article in the Anchorage Daily News. That's the year after CAC was incorporated. In full disclosure, I didn't have access to the full article in the Anchorage Daily News. But the Homer Tribune article about Melania talks about the original 1973 article. The writer had learned the story during an evening spent with the school teacher and his wife at English Bay, Nanuelet, while on a boat trip. Here's some of what it says.
Sometime in the beginning years of World War II, rumors began to seep along the Kenai Peninsula that things were not right in Portlock. Men from the cannery town would reportedly go up into the hills to hunt all sheep and bear, and never return. Worse yet, sometimes stories would circulate about mutilated bodies that were swept down into the lagoon, torn and dismembered in a way that bears could not, or would not, do.
So, the year after the CAC was formed, creepy stories start hitting the paper. Certainly is interesting timing. And Sally Ash also brought this up in her interview.
Yeah, it belongs to all of us. That is where our culture, that's where our people lived there and we have ties there. Since we left, a lot of boats have come in and just took stuff out. Old Victrolas, old books. They just disappeared and now all we have are rotting buildings there. Empty buildings with graffiti on some of them. When we go down we are not looking for things. We go down because we want to feel. There's people buried there. We want to feel connected to them. Our ancestors are buried there.
So, this theory that the natives have ulterior motives might actually make some sense. The natives own the land now and don't want people intruding on it, so they tell stories of a scary, murderous, potentially supernatural Bigfoot that supposedly turned Portlock into a ghost town. And Melania went even further and talked about the spirit woman in the creepy black dress. But even if this theory were true, I'm not sure it explains everything. Here's what I mean. Let's throw out everything that Melania and Sally said. Well, we've still got the 1905 story from Ed, in which the natives got spooked and left for a year because something was messing with them. Though, I haven't found this article, and Ed presumably didn't look into the issue until after his personal encounter, which also happened in 1973. But we've also got other stories about strange stuff happening after Portlock was abandoned, and I haven't seen anything to suggest that the natives are behind all of those stories. Though they might be. But from what I can tell, no one has actually denied the existence of this creature. Not even Sally Ash, who is even willing to rat out her own family member. So, while there might be something to this theory that the natives made up the story to protect their land, I don't think it necessarily disproves the existence of Nantinook. Theory 2. In this one, let's forget about why Portlock was abandoned and focus on a much more interesting fact. No one has actually denied that the Nantinook exists. We just need to figure out what it is. Well, we can start that process by looking at what Sally Ash said.
If you follow him, he will hide and he could turn into different animals. You can chase him and suddenly he disappears behind a tree, and when you get close enough to see him, all you see is a shimmering little mouse, shape-shifting. They would change to different animal, make you feel sad for them. They said don't touch them, just leave them alone.
And some said that when you cornered him, he would become violent, changing into an animal. Sally Ash also said don't bother shooting him. One man tried, and the creature just pulled the bullet out of his chest. Actually terrifying. And admittedly, I'm not the most familiar with the entities we're about to talk about yet, but Sally's description kind of sounds like a Native American skinwalker. In Navajo culture, a skinwalker is a type of harmful witch who has the ability to turn into, possess, or disguise themselves as an animal. It's pretty fascinating, and again, also terrifying. And there's another Native American entity called a Wendigo. It's got supernatural traits like a skinwalker, but has also been said to be a distant relative of the Bigfoot. And there's yet another entity called the Kushtaka, a shape-shifting cryptid that stalks Alaska's wilderness looking for human prey. It's capable of assuming human form, the form of an otter, and potentially other forms. The stories say that the Kushtaka would lure people into the water, then rip them to shreds, kinda like the remains allegedly found by the people of Portlock. To me, the Nantinook sounds like it has some traits of each of these entities, which might make it truly unique. By the way, I find the native culture and lore fascinating. So if you'd be interested in an episode about any of the entities we just talked about, let me know down in the comments or in our Discord in the episodes ideas section. I'm looking for pretty much any reason to research these topics. Theory 3. Portlock ended up abandoned because of the completion of Alaska Route 1, aka the Alaskan Highway, in the 1940s. Portlock wasn't along Route 1, and towns that were inaccessible by road, like Portlock, soon ended up abandoned in favor of places that were easier to access. The author of the article about Sally Ash also pointed out that the timing of the abandonment coincided with the extension of Alaska Highway Route 1 to Kenai and eventually Homer. Remember Homer, just north of Portlock on the other side of the bay? More on that in just a minute. But first, let's take a little tangent down the Alaskan Highway, aka Route 1, so we understand the backdrop at the time that Portlock was abandoned.
Rabbit hole warning.
So they started talking about putting a major roadway in Alaska in like 1930. Nothing happened. Government progress at its finest. But then Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, and an Alaskan highway was basically deemed a military necessity. President Roosevelt authorized construction of the Alaska Highway on February 11, 1942. So here's the deal. The U.S. was at war at this time, and this road needs to be completed. But they were in Alaska, one of the most unforgiving environments in the world. They can need that road done all they want, but if they don't get it done before winter starts, it's not getting done that year. So the government had a different sense of urgency than it did in the 1930s. The U.S. secured rights of way through Canada in March 1942. Then the Army Corps of Engineers started arriving. Construction on the Alaska Highway officially started on April 11, 1942. They had so many people and materials come in that it took them a month just to get everything in there. By June 1942, more than 10,000 American troops had arrived. They put together a plan and worked every day. And they got it done. Construction ended on October 25th, 1942, when it was possible for vehicles to travel the entire length of the highway. So, in fewer than 8 months, the Army Corps of Engineers had cleared and laid down 1,500 miles of highway. Now, the highway wasn't entirely finished. It would work for the military for the time being, but they still had to make it nice in the coming years. The government started paving it when winter was over the next year, and the Alaska Highway opened to the public the way it appears today in 1948. And this timing does line up pretty well with Portlock being completely abandoned by 1950. Here's a potential issue with this Route 1 theory, though. Melania's family moved to Nanuelik, probably before Route 1 was built, and, in any event, Route 1 never ran to Nanuelik, so Route 1 couldn't be the reason why her family moved there. Well, there's apparently some evidence that the individual canneries that dotted the Kenai shores eventually consolidated into fewer facilities in the towns that were still operating. Basically, the small towns on the peninsula were consolidating, and Portlock drew the short end of the stick. Maybe because there was a murderous supernatural Bigfoot there. But Sally Ash said something similar to this. She said that people would see Nantinook, but that's not why the people left the Portlock area.
People would see Nantinook, but that wasn't the reason why people moved this way to Seldovia and Nanuelik. They moved because of the economy, schools, and the church. There really was no killing of people.
So it seems unlikely that the Nantinook drove off the people of Portlock. But all three of these theories that we just discussed may have some element of truth. People along the peninsula could have consolidated into larger towns, naturally abandoning Portlock. The natives want it to stay abandoned, and the Nantinook might actually be out there. I think we'd probably call the evidence on this one inconclusive, which leaves the door open to more research, maybe some expeditions, and definitely some pretty cool possibilities, because there might just be a supernatural Bigfoot in southern Alaska. Here's the deal. I really want to know what you all think about this one. Do you think any of these theories that we talked about are more likely to be true than the others? Or do you have a really cool theory that I didn't mention at all? Let me know down in the comments, or type in your favorite punctuation mark. Tell me how bad my hair looks. Literally any engagement in the comments helps. And if you made it this far, I presume you enjoyed the episode. Hit the subscribe button to keep up with the channel and see similar content. I appreciate you taking the time to join me on this project. And we'll see you on the next one. Until then, watch out for the lizard people.